welcome to the latest Tablet podcast. My name is Ruth Gledhill and I'm an assistant editor of The Tablet. And with me today I'm excited to have Dr. Ambrogio Cayani. His book, Losing a Kingdom, Gaining the World, he dives into the history of the Catholic Church, but it's particularly the modern history. And he has become an expert through his research on the Catholic Church's historic and present treatment of women, as well as the LGBTQ plus community and modernity in all its forms. With the synod going on at the moment, this is, of course, a big talking point, all these issues within the church. So Ambrogio, can you tell us a little bit first about how you came to write this book and what the background to it is?
Thank you, Ruth. And it's such a thrill to be with you. Well, I guess all books are very personal to us. And despite my Italian surname, I grew up in Catholic Ireland in the 1980s and 1990s. So I always had a great interest for the church. As you can imagine, in Ireland with the Celtic Tiger and quite a number of scandals, it was a moment when Ireland went from almost being a quasi-theocratic state to then becoming, I would say, one of the least religiously minded states in Europe. And that change happened in barely a generation, if you think about it. So my interest has always been that. And then I found...
Whereabouts in Ireland were you?
So south of Dublin, Kildare.
And were you an altar boy, and did you go through the whole system like that?
I think because my parents were quite liberal Catholics, I never sort of got those privileges. Also, my parents didn't want me to take the pledge against having a drink of alcohol, because as Italians, they said, what's wrong with having a glass of wine with your meals? So the clergy always watched me with a little bit of distrust. And also, because I came from Italy and probably wasn't, and I didn't go to university in Ireland, I didn't have to learn Irish. So they always had an eye sort of looking at me, and a little distrustfully, I think. So I was never an altar boy.
I see. So sorry, carry on. You were saying what happened next in your journey.
And eventually I found a publisher mad enough to sort of allow me to write a political history of the Catholic Church. And actually the current book, Losing a Kingdom, Gaining the World, is basically the first volume of a bigger enterprise. You know, I've done the 18th and 19th century in this one. In the next one, it will be the 20th century. And my God, that's a daunting challenge. But maybe to make it a little bit more personal, I hope you don't mind me entering my own sort of issues and troubles. You know, as an Italian Catholic who grew up in Ireland, I've always sort of had a mind versus matter problem with the church. I guess when I go to my mind and my intellectual standpoint, I'm a liberal Catholic, a lover of Vatican II, really love a church who goes back to primitive Christianity and is inclusive in the community. But then, of course, there's the more emotive side. And I have to say, when you see some of the relics, great shrines of pilgrimage, I really am, I've got a grudging admiration for a Catholicism that's baroque, that refuses to yield just because fashion changes. And I get very sort of emotionally attached to this. I don't know if you've ever heard in Italy of these wonderful little sort of silver plaques called ex voti, which are placed near Madonnas and relics.
Yes.
And there's a Madonna in Monza, where my family are from, who's utterly sort of littered in them. And of course, that means that these people have prayed for a grace or some special favor from the Madonna and have received it. And I always lie there thinking, what on earth were these people praying for? What did they receive? I sometimes wonder if my own great-grandmother, when she had a miscarriage, probably put one of those there. So I'm deeply sort of attracted by some of the old spirituality, but my head doesn't always follow my heart. I don't know if that makes any sense.
It totally does. It totally does. So where does your head go then when you were looking at this and looking into these practices and into these great traditions of the church?
Well, my head has always wondered, why did it take so long to get to Vatican II? Why was the church so slow to do things that, you know, Martin Luther had started in the 16th century? And what I discovered in the book is actually that, how do you call it, Pius IX and the First Vatican Council infallibility and the closure from the modern world probably wasn't inevitable. It was a series of accidents and problems that probably led us to that intransigent, closed church that fought modernity rather than found an accommodation with it. You know, the 18th century is a wonderfully reformist place. A friend of mine and colleague, Sean Blanchard, who teaches at a Franciscan university in Miami, has actually discovered that a lot of Vatican II is probably inspired by some of the Jansenist or reform writings of the 18th century. But I mean, my hero really in the 18th century is Pope Benedict XIV. You know, when he was Cardinal of Bologna, he admitted three women to PhD equivalents at the time in mathematics, physics, and anatomy. And I just think it's such a shame that that wasn't the path followed. He even accepted dedications from Voltaire or Montesquieu. He was very plugged into the Enlightenment.
That's extraordinary. We know very little about that in the modern era. So what made you begin then with the, in your book, Losing a Kingdom, Gaining the World, what made you begin with the aftermath of the French Revolution?
Well, I actually started in the 17th century, and I was just interested in how the church really did engage with the Enlightenment for quite a bit, that it was possibilist, that it accepted reforms imposed on it by the state, that it was a bit more open. But the French Revolution and then Napoleon is what scares it. And justifiably so. I don't want to sound like I'm somebody who's always critical of the church. You know, the French in 1798 invade the Papal States. They take Pius VI prisoner, and he eventually dies in Valence in revolutionary France. And the town registrar records the death of Jean-Ange Brasky, exercising the profession of a pontiff, which is rather laconic death certificate for the supreme pontiff of the Roman world. And it seemed, you know, that Catholicism might not get a legitimate pope elected in conclave after that. But the cardinals did meet in Venice and they elected Pius VII, who soon ran into some trouble with Napoleon himself and would spend 5 years as Napoleon's prisoner. So that's the point in which you can see that the popes are starting to say, well, we tried to find an accommodation with modernity, with the change of the revolution, and our fingers were so badly burned that we're not going to really continue down this path.
Yes, I don't want to jump about too much, but a quick fast forward, and then we'll go back to this era. Benedict the 16th, when he, as Ratzinger, is said to have been frightened out of his own liberal tendencies by the student revolutions of the 1960s, and that in Paris and that's in France. That's quite interesting, isn't it? That it's these, the church is kind of moving in the liberal direction, as you know, and then it gets frightened back in tradition, into conformity, and into resisting change, because of the terrible aftermaths of the violence that come with revolution.
I mean, I think people really forget that, don't they? But at the Second Vatican Council, he was the official theologian, was it, for the Cardinal Archbishop of Cologne, Cardinal Frings?
Yes.
Who was a voice who actually criticised Cardinal Ottaviani, who was the great defender of tradition as the sort of last prefect of the Holy Office, I think, who had the rather terrifying motto, Semper Idem, always the same. So, you know, Cardinal Ratzinger at that time, sorry, well, I guess Monsignor, he would have been Father Ratzinger, Father Josef Ratzinger at that time, was very much on that liberal wing. But, you know.
Yes, and then so it's interesting that this goes, you know, that it's happened before, and you spell this out in your book. So after being frightened by the consequences of the French Revolution and then struggling, I suppose, the church leaders then saw as to survive, simply to survive, and retreating in tradition was a way to survive. There were very long consequences to that, weren't there, that played out, but the church did survive.
It did. And I think what I always find quite difficult, and the church is sometimes a victim of its own success in the sense that we see the church as very much vested in the papacy, highly centralized. But of course, that hides the fact that the church in reality is a loose confederation of warring tribes. And it was equally the case in the 19th century. Some of my favorite movements like liberal Catholicism, social Catholicism, are all bubbling beneath the surface. The curia may be against them and may not like them, but they're still there. And I have a lot of sort of liberal heroes in this period. You know, Lamine is a wonderful one, Antonio Rosmini as well, Gioberti. These are all great thinkers who believe that the church has nothing to fear from liberalism, that actually the church being disestablished from the state is an opportunity rather than a problem. So they're all there, despite the fact that the popes may not like them and may not want to engage with them. But slightly, I don't want to jump about either, Ruth, but maybe going back to your Ratzinger comment, the man who really is scared in this period is one of the, well, if you exclude St. Peter, the Pope who reigned the longest, Pius IX, from 1846 to 1878. And, you know, people always remember him as the Pope of tradition, the Pope of the Syllabus of Errors, the Pope of infallibility. But the first 2 years of his pontificate, a bit like Benedict XVI, he begins as a liberal. He lets people out of prison. He starts liberalizing the laws. He starts bringing gas lamps to Rome. I'm really jumping with my technology. He starts making projects to build the railway. He even gives the Papal States, although there's a bit of pressure behind this, its first constitution where lay people are allowed to administer the secular might of the Papal States. But then revolution comes. And in November 1848, his favorite minister, I'm going to call him a prime minister, although technically he was Minister of the Interior, Rossi, is actually murdered by the crowds in Rome going up to Palazzo della Cancelleria. And Pius IX is surrounded. Actually, one of his papal translators who helps him with his Latin encyclicals is killed by a stray gunshot at this time. So the Pope decides to flee his capital. And I fear that perhaps a bit like Benedict XVI, he learns the wrong lesson. He believes that his concessions and his liberalism was a mistake. He was punished by God and that he must go back to tradition, and that compromise is what destroys the church rather than allows it to survive. So that's part of the problem. There's always reformism and new ideas within the church, but the papacy keeps getting very, very scared in the 19th century.
Yes, I mean, and now, of course, we kind of got the opposite with a pope who is really wanting to embrace reform and appears to be trying to embrace reform, and, you know, at quite a speed. And it's the cardinals and the bishops and the clergy who are scared and trying to hold everything back. But yes, to go back then to what was happening in the 19th and early 20th centuries. Ultramontanism came in then, didn't it, as a kind of very strong reaction to the moves towards modernism. And modernism became a hated word, rather like liberalism has become in some quarters today.
Well, until Vatican II, priests had to take an oath that they would avoid modernism with all their forces. There was actually, you know, you couldn't become a priest without swearing that you would keep away from anything modern.
What was modernism? And for I'm sure all our listeners know all this, but to help me, what was ultramontanism exactly?
Well, the church of the 18th century is much different from the church today. You know, priests had their own traditions and autonomies and liberties. They were sort of, churches were organized along national lines. You had the Gallican church in France, which had its own liturgical practices, its own dress. You had the Reichskirche in the old Holy Roman Empire, which was very similar. I mean, what I think is ridiculous, and it's quite funny, the French church never registers the canons of the Council of Trent. It never really becomes law within the French state because they're so resistant. They're saying, you know, the Pope is only first among equals. We shouldn't be forced with this. They also have the four Gallican liberties. So ultramontanism, as the term implies, is ultra, meaning beyond, and montes, the mountains. So the church, instead of looking at home, looks beyond the Alps to Rome. And this is a more centralizing idea. And, you know, in the 19th century, priests all start dressing in what's called the Roman fashion, which I guess is the fashion of today, although Vatican II has modernized it, and starts really hanging on papal pronouncements. And technology, which I think is often forgotten, and I do mention this in the book, comes to the Pope's help. The telegraph and eventually radio communication means that where once, you know, communicating with missionary churches in Canada or South America would take weeks and weeks and months, can now happen in a matter of minutes or hours. So I think that does help. Yeah.
Sorry. So are you saying then, just to dwell on that point for a few seconds, That's interesting. That had never occurred to me before. That before modern, the speed of modern communications, the churches outside of Rome, the separate provinces, were actually able to go their own way with more freedom because comms were so slow. And I guess that now I think about it, that makes absolute sense. So you had more diversity really within the universal church than one does now, because now a simple tweet can call, or an X, as we, I suppose we should call it now, can call a reprobate church or cleric into line, whereas before it would take a man on horseback to go days and weeks.
And sailing ships
And
crossing
sailing
very
ships.
dangerous oceans, which would often sort of the ships would sink and all that. I mean, my favorite story of this, it's unfortunately not actually in the book, but there's a lot of communication with the Jesuits in Canada. And at one point, the Holy See is sending messages to a group of missionaries who've actually been massacred by sort of the local population. So they're gone, they're communicating pointlessly. So, yeah, that's absolutely true, Ruth. Yeah.
Gosh, and so modern comms, while it also helps to generate subversion and can foment rebellion, it also does facilitate the people in power to maintain uniformity and control, doesn't it? That you can see that there's a really strong tendency that way, and you can see that working out at the moment with what's happening in the synod.
Absolutely.
So how was modernism, which to my mind, and to people who might support more liberal tendencies within the church, would have sounded like a good thing. How was that so comprehensively defeated in the end? Even Vatican II seems to, instead of letting modernism off its leash, seems to, in retrospect, have just strengthened the bounds of tradition in so many respects.
So I think you're absolutely right to use the word modernism. I think technically it emerges in the first decade of the 20th century, but it's there implicitly, and they talk of the modern world. But ultimately, I think what's really worrying them, and I think the people the church hate most, and clearly this will make me feel uncomfortable, they really don't like historians. And why don't they like historians? Because historians sort of start noticing things that are very worrying to a church that has recently come across, or that has recently restated this idea of the deposit of faith. And this is important. This has not actually changed. This is one of the problems also with the synod. Christ,
So
sorry.
just to dwell on that for a second then. So you talk about the deposit of faith, but it's different from the evangelical and the non-Catholic churches going towards the evangelical side, not talking about the Orthodox here, but towards the Protestant wing of the Christian spectrum. The churches, the deposit of faith is the Bible, really, but the Catholic Church has all this massive archive, this massive magisterium of teaching documents. So why does that keep it stuck then, which is what I think you might have been implying, rather than allowing it to develop and move forward? Because you'd have thought with all this writing and depositing going on, that things were developing and ideas were moving forward like they do in science and other academic disciplines.
Well, indeed. I mean, the Protestant vision of scripture is that it's quite liberal if you think about it. We're all allowed to read the Bible and we're all allowed to interpret it, and that will bring us to a closer connection with God through scripture. Whereas Catholics should not, according to the 19th century vision, approach the Bible on their own. They have to do it through the supreme teaching authority, which is the papacy. Because ultimately, when Christ suffers his passion in 33 AD, revelation and God's action upon earth ceases. Everything we need to know about God, everything we need to know about the sacred, about God's actions on earth, are contained in those sacred writings. And it is for the Pope, who can use these writings to clarify God's teachings, Christ's teachings, but no change occurs. We are merely defending a deposit. And the church's teachings have been the same according to this vision since 33 AD to 2000. And of course, theologians and historians say that this is a load of proverbial. It's utterly sort of insane in some ways, especially in the 19th century, when you start getting people like Strauss or Ernest Renan looking for the historical Christ. And they start discovering that actually the church was governed very differently. In the worst cases, like people, this is beyond the period of my book, but like Alfred Loisy say that actually, if you read the Bible or the Gospels very carefully, you know, Christ mentions the kingdom of God quite a lot, but never really mentions the church that much or hierarchies. And that therefore that was subsequent to it. And therefore the church basically places all of these nice people on the index and tells them to be to behave and to leave well enough alone. Now, modernism is not all good, and maybe more in its Protestant incarnation. One of the things that also happens, and I find it all deeply disturbing, is that a tomb is found in the middle of Germany, I think close to Munster, don't quote me on this one, of a Tiberius Pantera, who was a standard bearer of a legion in Palestine, probably of Syrian birth. And some clever Protestants who are worried about the Jewishness of Jesus and the Jewish origins of Christianity say, actually, this guy was probably the real father of Jesus, and therefore there is actually a more Aryan and non-Jewish part of this faith. And that's where modernism can get dangerous. There are negative aspects to it as well. When you start attacking one level of sort of absurdities with others, so it's not all good. One has to be very careful and discriminating also with not everything that's modern is good.
Totally see that.
And the other thing which I think is great, you know, the church does learn a lesson from Galileo that when it comes to science, it's best to wait and see a little more. You know, Catholics don't have that much of a problem with Darwin or Mendel and genetics as sort of the Protestant churches have. Pius IX doesn't really, as far as I can see, trouble himself too much with good old Darwin, which I think is probably for the better.
Yeah. Now, you argue in the book that Catholicism lost its temporal power, but as this happened, it made huge spiritual strides and expanded across the globe, gaining converts throughout the global south, America, Africa, the Far East. And you have this phrase, losing a kingdom but gaining the world. And what do you mean by that? And does it still have the world, or is it now in danger of losing the world as well?
Oh, that's such a wonderful way of trying to come to grips with this. And I think what ultimately changed is that the Pope weirdly loses his title and his status as a prince in central Italy. And there's a paradox here. It liberates him in some ways, because so much of papal history is trying to preserve this sort of narrow, or this central Italy as a temporal power. But once that happens, and once there's a separation of church and state, you know, because if you think about it, in the 18th century, I think something like 80% of bishops were named by monarchies. The Pope, it wasn't quite clear whether the Pope could remove bishops on his own authority. By the First Vatican Council, when he loses his kingdom and he becomes infallible, he has a renewed spiritual authority, which he had never had before. And this allows him, you know, a patronage and an ability to sort of send out missionaries, restructure the church, which he never had before. And it's one of the great ages of spiritual expansion. There are converts made outside of the Catholic heartlands of Europe and the Americas, you know, Africa, the Philippines, Japan, which had been highly problematic in the 17th century, are all the church makes an amazing number of new souls. The means it employs for this through its missionary activities are mixed, to say the least. I don't think that from our perspective today, the collusion with Europe's empires would go down very well. But it's clear that the Pope has this renewed spiritual impetus to send out missionaries and to look to the universal church, which he just didn't have the time to do when he was a secular ruler of a small Italian principality.
Yes. Now, especially given current events at the moment in the Middle East, let's just take a little look at this very important era in the Church's history and the series of concordats with fascist states in the 30s. How on earth did those terrible errors of judgment come to pass, do you think?
Well, this is a really tricky one. The church has had dozens and dozens of concordats from the 17th century until the present age. You know, Mussolini's concordat, apart from a minor revision in the 1980s, is still in force in Italy. People often forget that. Documents and agreements are not intrinsically good or bad, but it depends how they're applied. And I think part of the problem is they thought they could actually come to an arrangement with monsters like Mussolini and Hitler. And they should have known from another concordat I look in the book, the one with Napoleon in 1801, that you need to be careful of who you trust. In fact, at the moment, one of the, it's not called a concordat, it's what is it, the Sino-Vatican Agreement with the People's Republic of China, is highly concerning because basically the People's Republic of China gets a say in who becomes a bishop in China. But the problem is that the church, in order to maintain its property, its freedom, is willing to sell the rest of the population. And not only that, but, you know, Italy and Germany in the 1920s and 1930s had some pretty vibrant Catholic parties. And they basically trade those for concordats. The Partito Popolare Italiano is basically dissolved almost by order of the Holy See. And the Zentrumpartei in Germany, the Holy See stays well away from it, but it's also dissolved as part of a means of showing that they are willing to come to terms with Hitler. So the terms and the articles themselves aren't a mistake. And I think actually part of the Reichskonkordat with Hitler is still in force even to this day. But believing that Hitler would hold to any agreement is a massive error in judgment. Pacelli, who became Pope Pius XII, famously said that he knew that Hitler would violate some of the articles of the Concordat, but he didn't actually believe he'd violate them all at the same time, almost simultaneously.
I mean, there's a lot of controversy about Pope Pius XII and his role in the war and in what happened in the Holocaust. And the church did kind of repent of its attitude towards the Jewish people at the Second Vatican Council and after the in the doc, you know, after the council. How do you think, what do you think, where do you think we are with that now and with the church? And it is interesting in relation to what's happening in China as well at the moment, and there's quite a lot of criticism of Pope Francis, as you know, about his deal with the Chinese.
Well, but even in the Second Vatican Council, this is work in progress because the next book will be on the 20th century. But I've been reading O'Malley's wonderful book, What Happened at Vatican II. And the patriarch, what is it, Maxenius the Fourth Singh of the, I think of the Syrian church, of the Syrian sort of Orthodox church, but in communion with Rome, was one of those wonderful presences at the Second Vatican Council. And he's actually one of the main reasons we have non-Latin mass or masses in vernacular, because he said, you know, in my tradition, we've been saying mass in Syriac for millennia. Why can't Rome abandon Latin? But at the same time, I think, you know, Nostra Aetate, which is the great opening to other religions and not just condemnation. And it's especially important with Judaism, where there's a recognition of the Jews as being the elder brothers of Christianity, who started the journey before us. One thing that is taken out of the document under Maxenius's influence, because he has an Arab constituency at home and he doesn't think people will accept it, is the accusation of deicide. That, unfortunately, was one in one of the earlier drafts of Nostra Aetate, but unfortunately, it's not removed. Equally, we have John Paul II later, in some very moving moments, you know, recognizing the ills that the church has done to sort of the Jews, and also the first pope to send a nuncio to Israel in the 1990s, long overdue. But my book does also look at some of the more horrific things in the period beforehand. I don't know how well a British public knows about Edgardo Mortara affair, which has recently been made into a film in Italy?
Not at all. So please do enlighten us.
So in 1858, in an apartment in Bologna, late at night, there's a knock on the door. It's a Jewish family called the Mortaras. The mother of the family opens the door and it's papal gendarmes. And they say, we want to see your children. The father's out on a walk at this stage. And the mother, as a Jewish lady, realizes that nothing good comes of the papal police knocking on a Jewish door, shows the children and they go through them. And they ask, where is little Edgardo? And she says, he's sleeping, six-year-old. He's sleeping in his bed. They say, well, we'd like to see him. The father returns at this stage and they inform the terrified couple that unbeknownst to them, a member of their household covertly baptized the child and that therefore under canon law, a Christian cannot be raised by Jews. After 2 days of negotiations, the child is ripped from its family and taken to Rome and placed in the house of catechumens. The child is then converted fully into Catholicism. Pius IX personally meets with the child and treats him almost like a godson. And there's massive European public outcry against this. What's his name? Moses Montefiore, one of the key philanthropists and leaders of English Judaism, travels to Rome to try to persuade the Pope to return the child, but he says he cannot go against canon law. Edgardo eventually becomes a very fervent Catholic priest. Even when Italy is united and Rome is taken away from the Pope, he doesn't want to return to his Jewish family. Years later, he would meet his mother, but it's sort of a tragic meeting in which all he tried to do was to persuade her to convert to Christianity, and she, with great dignity, says no. In some ways, it's an easy case because we know, and I think the church knew at the time, that it is monstrous to deprive families of their children. But at the same time, I can't blame Edgardo. He was so brainwashed that he couldn't really return to his original self. So it's a terrible, terrible case.
And I did know about this, and the church doesn't come out of it at all well.
No, I'm afraid. It's a big part of my seventh chapter. But it's good that we have moved beyond this, and I think it's just so important that we continue on this road to better comprehension. And it's good in some ways that Francis has opened the archives on the Second World War. It just shows that he is such a wonderful man and not scared of the truth.
Yes, and things are moving forwards. But on the place in the church of LGBTQ plus people and of women as well, have you found out interesting developments there? And where do you see that going under Francis's reforms? And what have you found out in the past about that?
No, that is a very good question. And this is where I can only really give a personal opinion because I don't, unfortunately, have insider contacts in the synod. I think in some ways, the church in the 19th century doesn't really focus on LGBT or women because the state enforces enough discrimination against women and gay people. And I'm LGBT myself, so I understand this question very well. It's only in the 20th century when homosexuality begins to be decriminalized and equal rights legislation emerges that the church gets very worried that it no longer has the partnership of the state to impose discriminatory measures against it, and therefore it needs to start campaigning against it. And I think we've really been badly hurt by the church, you know, in the 1990s and early 2000s. I still remember Cardinal Bertone saying that the only reason there was a child abuse crisis was because child abusers were homosexual or something like that. I mean, a terrible sort of false analogies and links to this. And it seems to me that things are changing, but we have to be careful. I think a lot of people on both sides see the synod as almost a parliament or something that's going to determine the issue. It's a first step. And it's useful that this is now on the cards, that it is being discussed. But I think anybody who thinks that next October, when the synod reaches its deliberative stage or a text emerges that, you know, we're going to move to sort of women priests or an acceptance of gay marriage, I think that won't happen. But I do think a more pastorally open church, one that doesn't tell you that you are somebody that has to have the doors of the church slammed on their face or whatever, is already a big step forward, personally at least.
I mean, it does seem that with as you mentioned decriminalization of homosexuality and you know throughout the whole of the 20th century there was this move towards certainly in the Western world greater equality of women and giving women the vote and that kind of thing. And it does seem that the church is looking increasingly out of step with modern society on these two issues, the issues of women and the issues of LGBT people. And it's difficult to see where that's going to go for the church because younger generations coming up simply cannot comprehend an institution or structure that still maintains these teachings at its very heart. Again, excluding women and LGBT people from full participation, really, in the church's mission and in what the church believes. And it's difficult when you if you look forward to the future to think how the church can ultimately survive this.
I couldn't agree more. It makes, I mean, it makes little historical sense. I mean, when you read the Gospels, the different Marys and the Marthas seem to be very active and, valued by Jesus as much as anybody else. And I don't think the idea that only the priest can be persona Christi at the consecration of the Eucharist has much legs to stand on. I find it utterly ridiculous. And also, I do think that it is rather patronizing when men discuss female issues. I mean, Mary McAleese put it very well in a different podcast where she said, they'd have a very different mentality if they'd ever changed the nappy. I mean, it must be terrible for couples who want to be married in a Catholic church to have to undergo a marriage course with a priest who has no family, has no experience of relationships, and is giving advice on something of which he personally knows nothing. I'm sure that he can empathize and he can give some common sense advice, but it is, I mean, it verges on the perverse, I would say.
When you are looking back at the history, as you have been doing, as you are immersed in doing through researching this book and the next one, and the church's struggles throughout the period you're writing about, is it correct to say that these struggles were mainly concerned with political developments, whereas now the church seems to be struggling more with social developments?
Oh, I'm not so sure. I think power is the great drug to which the church is deeply addicted. When the great moment when Constantine incorporates the church as an arm of the empire, that's Christianity's greatest moment. It really becomes then addicted to power. By the Middle Ages, the Pope claims to be more powerful than temporal rulers. And I don't think, especially the Curia, the papal administration has ever been able to let go of that. And that is just so difficult for those who are more careerist. I mean, I think that's the battle that Francis is fighting and finding so difficult, that there are many within the church who still have that addiction to power and relevance. But given what's happening, they're actually accelerating even the political decline rather than saving what they think they're saving.
Yes, yeah, so how does continuing to exclude LGBT people and women perpetuate the sense of power or the reality of power, maybe?
Well, I mean, in some ways it's simple. At the moment, only half the population of the world can become cardinals. If you add the other half, there are less jobs for the boys, aren't there? I mean, I think, sorry, that's very vulgar of me to put it like that.
No, absolutely. Well, that's sadly, sometimes the simplest truth is the right one.
It's a bit more competition, isn't it? And how do you call it? We poor old boys have started to notice that women are very competent. They're very good at what they do, and that's probably irksome for some. The LGBT one, I think it's there. I'm even more worried because it's so prurient. There's so little in the gospel. It just lacks humanity and charity, I would argue. But I have to be careful as well. I mean, one of my sins is I do sort of view traditionalists through a negative lens, and it's never a good thing for a Christian to view anybody as an enemy, and I do have to keep that in check. I'm sure that there are very genuine traditionalists who deeply believe things and deeply believe the faith that was handed down from generation to generation. And I can understand that, because I also am in awe of some of the rituals and some of the old spirituality, but I don't see why one can't do both.
Absolutely. When you were researching the book, did you travel much? Did you go to some interesting libraries and places?
So I've been very fortunate. So to be entirely honest, my previous book, which was on Napoleon's kidnapping of Pope Pius VII, I spent substantial time in the Vatican archives. Then COVID struck. So a lot of this was written during COVID. So it's more a work of synthesis. But, you know, I've been to the archives in Paris and the Vatican one. So I've drawn from a lot of primary texts. I've also drawn from a lot of the church's publications. You know, the Vatican archives have their own press. And they print a lot of the sources. You know, before the opening of the archives on the Second World War, the Vatican in the 1970s published 12 volumes of sources on the Second World War. So I've been using a lot of those, but the Vatican archives are such a wonderful place to work. I mean, I was taken there by the late Marcel Chapin, who was a deputy prefect in various moments of his career. And he took me to something called the Tower of the Winds, which I didn't realize existed. And it had been built to prove Galileo wrong. But I hope this won't sound too vulgar, but apparently while they were doing the calculations and using the frescoes to map the night sky, they went, oh, bugger it, he's probably right. So no, I've been really lucky. And I also sound like I'm a terrible sort of fanatic liberal, but I think there's wonderful people within the church. And I consider myself blessed in so many ways to be Catholic. But I just wish we moved a little bit more quickly.
Yes, you sound very passionate about it, though. So I wouldn't worry about sounding sounding too liberal. Not that there's anything necessarily wrong with that. But was there any particular story or thing you uncovered that really stood out to you as moving or surprising or shocking?
There are so many. I mean, moving, I find when female convents were closed during the French Revolution against the will of the nuns, that most of them, I think about 70%, kept living as communities in secret. I found that deeply moving as a form of female solidarity. And the nuns...
How did they do that? Were they just living and going out doing secular jobs, but continuing to meet and communicate?
Yeah, I mean, I hope people won't find this comparison offensive, but it was a bit like hiding from the Nazis, because during the terror, they were being sought out. And the story of the nuns of Compiègne, which was put to music by a wonderful opera by François Poulenc, Dialogue de Carmélite, you know, the nuns are found and they're executed by guillotine. But I think they're singing the Veni Creator Spirito one by one as they mount the scaffold and are beheaded. And slowly it becomes one sole female voice, the voice of the prioress. I found that incredibly moving. I wish I had that strong a faith. Mm. What I found shocking was the story of Jean Mellier. He died in 1729, an unremarkable parish priest in Champagne. And people were going through his will, and they found a massive manuscript. People went, oh, we didn't realize he was writing this. And basically the manuscript begins by saying, my life is a lie. I don't believe in God. And I've asked forgiveness of my parishioners because I've been spreading a false ideology amongst them. This is probably one of the first militant atheist texts that's ever been found, but it's more unique than rare. We can't find many others. There's a Polish one from the 17th century, which is less well known, but it's a really fervent manifesto of atheism. I can't say I particularly like it, but I was shocked by it and thought it was incredible. It's got the terrible phrase in it that the world will only be happy when the last nobleman is hanged with the intestines of the last priest.
Oh dear, oh my goodness. Where has all this history and looking into the past and the church's sins and presumably also its good points, where has all this left your own faith? Am I allowed to ask you that?
Oh, I think you definitely are. I wish I sometimes do feel a bit of a hypocrite. I find in myself the criticism I often make in others, that I sort of say, well, you say nice things, but your behavior is otherwise. I'm the same. I criticize the traditionalists, but I do wish I was a bit more charitable and a bit more patient. And also, I do wish that I had the simpler faith of my Italian grandparents. I think they were happier with it. I just find that sometimes the cold, let's say, mind bit can ruin your faith or get in the way.
Yes, I can understand that. But it's probably more complex, though, isn't it, actually, fundamentally, for most people?
Oh, definitely. I think also part of the problem is that a lot of the language and a lot of the spirituality of the church is just so difficult from a 21st century vantage point. Listen to the Holy Spirit. I try, but there is a lot of noise out there. And, you know, both the traditionalists and the liberals say they listen to the Holy Spirit. It's just tricky. And the other thing, which I'm probably being very unfair, but sometimes I am very unfair on my local parish priest. I'm a nightmare parishioner because I get very angry with some sermons. I remember a recent one in Italy and this is where I should just be quiet, because, you know, the chap was in his late 80s, and it was for Corpus Christi. And he said, there are probably people in the congregation who don't believe in the real presence of Christ. And I tell you, in the 16th or 17th century, there was a farmer or peasant who thought the same. And he decided to stand rather than kneel when the host went by. And then what do you think happened? And I was wondering what great sort of proof he would formulate for the presence of Christ and the host. He said, didn't his donkey kneel instead of him? Anyway, God, is that the best you can do? And I do actually believe in the real presence, but I think Accidents and Substance, some of Thomas Aquinas, is probably better than donkeys kneeling.
Yes.
I'm being such a curmudgeon today.
No, not at all. I mean, I think that is really enlightening, and that says a lot. And I think that speaks to people, really. And that is the modern age. You know, that's the reality that we're facing. We can't retreat into those old forms of kind of folk religion type of belief, because people want something better, more complex, more based on evidence today. And the church has, like it or not, the church has to live in an environment of high science and high intellect.
Although, Ruth, I guess if we were traditionalists, we were probably saying, wouldn't it be better to have a smaller church of more fervent believers rather than one that's contaminated with a la carte Catholics? That is one of the arguments made. I don't personally agree with it, but because I think Christ was all embracing. You know, he spent a lot of times with people of dubious repute, maybe more than with the elite of his age.
Well, I hope that you'll explore that argument in your second book, because I think that is a really interesting path to go down and look at. And I think that this is the challenge the church is facing, and the synod is bringing this challenge into light, that, you know, does the church go down this path of a very small remnant of fervent ultra-Orthodox believers, or does it open the doors to everybody and do what the traditionalists would probably say would be to incur a disastrous dilution of its fundamental message?
Yeah, or God's thunderbolt, who knows? I mean, another wonderful thing that happened is when the bishops of the First Vatican Council voted for papal infallibility, and this is, I think, is true, it's confirmed, a lightning bolt hit St. Peter's Dome. So it's not quite clear whether that was divine anger or approbation, depending on which side of the debate you were on, I guess.
When I was on the Times for a few years, writing about religion, there seemed to be thunderstorms every year or so, and every year the Church of England, it seemed, I'm probably exaggerating it now in light of looking back at it, but the Church of England seemed to regularly make decisions which would then result in a cathedral being hit by lightning. And so these were fantastic stories to write, but obviously I wouldn't claim that they were scientifically legitimate exercises of the power of God against the little old Church of England.
No, although a thunderstorm did push Luther to become an Augustinian monk, so who knows, maybe God does work in very mysterious and meteorological ways.
Yes. So thank you very much for talking to me, Ambrogio. Your book, Losing a Kingdom, Gaining the World, The Catholic Church in the Age of Revolution and Democracy, is published by Head of Zeus. It's available in hardback for £30. And how you can buy this online and find out more about the book and about Ambrogio is available in the show notes. Thank you for listening, and I look forward to meeting you all again in the next Tablet podcast.